call to order the Senate Committee on Commerce. All of us sit on the Judiciary Committee, and all of us were there almost till 3 o'clock, some of us till after 3. We'll have two other members that will be coming in. Because of that, we won't be able to conduct all of the business that we want to do, but what we are going to do is start at this time. I want to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1057. I'll make a couple of comments regarding 1057. This is a work of a that has been ongoing. We had another bill, which I believe was Senate Bill 626, if I remember correctly, that started originally with some of the concepts that are captured in Senate Bill 1057. We had two different hearings on that bill, which included March 10th as well as April 14th. The concepts that are now that make up 1057 or will be making up 1057 is in fact were commented on it to some level at the Eugene meeting. With that said, I've opened up a public hearing. I'm going to go ahead and call up the people who have on the list, and we'll make certain that we've given everyone the opportunity to testify. Based on the list, it looks like everyone's within 100 miles of the Capitol, so what I'm going to do is take proponents first, and it looks like we have one possible objection at this point. So what I'm going to start off, I'm going to call a Greg Macasian. If you'll please come forward, and I'm going to go ahead and let yourself, and I'm going to go ahead and call Kevin Neely and Bill Seeley up to the dais at this point. And I think what we're going to do is first let Anna give us an overview of what we have, where we're at with 1057, and what are the various amendments we have. I anticipate, based on some conversations I've had earlier this morning as well as yesterday, there may be a few other modifications that we may be wanting to make before we take the bill out of this committee and send it to the floor, if we have the support. So with that said, Greg, if you'd be so kind to identify yourself and go ahead and give us your...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Malkasian. I am the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
It's not good. No, wait. Thank you. I told her that I was going to do this. I am still getting in trouble almost every time. I'm going to ask you to hold your testimony because I want Anna to please just give us an overview because we have a lot of new stuff that's before us. And I think for all of us here at the dais, it would be important for everyone to be more informed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1057 requires a notification on breach of security of personal information. It requires a security alert to be placed in a credit report upon the breach. It allows consumers to block release of the credit information, requires careful disposal of records, provides for a private right of action enforcement by the Attorney General, provides specific protection for Social Security numbers, and makes violations of those protections a Class A misdemeanor. We have five different sets of amendments, and I would be happy to go through the amendments if the committee would like, or we can wait for people to talk about them.
Randy, I think I'm going to hold off on going through each of the amendments because I know that we're going to have a little bit more work on this, and it might be better to kind of take it more succinct than just laying everything on the table at this point. So, Greg, if you'll continue, I apologize.
Thank you very much. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Malkasian. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today. I've provided written testimony, and I'll try to make sure the key elements of that testimony is discussed today. But we would like to provide specific support for aspects of the bill and acknowledge the consumer protections contained within the bill. The bill is aimed at preventing and reducing the impact of identity theft. Nationally, identity theft has topped consumer fraud complaints in 2004 for the fifth straight year, and Oregon consistently has ranked in the top 10 among states with the problem. I think this was expressed at the Eugene hearing that you mentioned earlier, Chair Pozanski. In the past few months, we have seen disclosures in national press about unauthorized access to credit reporting and similar databases, and you've probably seen the coverage in the most recent days regarding this particular problem. In an effort to combat the rapidly escalating number of identity thefts, a number of states, including California, Texas, and just this week, the state of Washington, have adopted laws to protect their consumers in their states related to breaches of security and allow them to place a security freeze on their credit reports. Senate Bill 1057, as Anna had expressed earlier, provides that when there is a breach of security and there is a potential threat of misuse of that personal information, that the business that was involved with that security breach does notify the consumer and also notifies the credit reporting agencies. It allows that a security alert will not be, that is placed on the credit report, is not used against the consumer with respect to creditworthiness. A consumer notified of the breach may place a security freeze on their credit report so that the credit reporting agency does not release their credit report without the consumer's permission. The bill also limits the disclosure to a third party of an individual's Social Security number, except for specific purposes, and establishes, as Ms. Braun explained, a violation is a Class A misdemeanor. The bill also specifies reasonable measures to dispose of personal information and protect against the unauthorized use of or access of the information. The bill provides that the violations of the Act constitute a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, enforceable by the Attorney General, and also creates a private right of action for a consumer injured by a violation. The Dash 2 amendments that we've asked the committee to consider, this bill ensures that the consumer receives notification that describes the incident and the type of information that was the subject of the unauthorized access, as well as advising the consumer to be vigilant to the possibility of identity theft, to promptly report any incidents that may be that they may place a security freeze on their credit report, and that information is available regarding steps consumers may take to protect themselves. The amendment also specifies different options for delivery by first-class mail, electronic mail, or direct communication by telephone to ensure that the consumer receives the information while giving business options of how the notification can be provided. The Dash 2 amendments also provide that a credit reporting agency notify consumers who have a security alert or flag on their credit report each time a business or person requests a consumer's credit information, and how the consumer may contact the person requesting the credit information. This is important. It provides a means for the consumer to contact the person requesting the information if the consumer is not seeking credit from that person. We understand this is an industry practice and believe it has been an important element to protect consumers. While all aspects of the bill provide increased consumer protection, we understand that, as you said earlier, there are a lot of issues that will be discussed today, and you'll receive testimony that will urge certain changes to the bill. We particularly recommend that key elements of consumer protection in the bill be retained. Those elements are the notification of a security breach, placing a security alert flag on the consumer's credit reports after a breach, and then the notification by the credit reporting agency as outlined in the Dash 2 amendments. This is an especially important element because a consumer should have a right to be able to take action rather than wait until they become a victim of identity theft. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or be available for questions later.
All right, thank you. What I'm going to do is take the testimony from everyone on the panel, and then we'll open it up for questions. Mr. Neely, if you'll go next.
Thank you, Chair Prozonski. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely. I'm Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Justice. Senate Bill 1057 is a bill that the Attorney General strongly supports. We believe that this provides really critical protections for Oregon consumers. As you know, and as Mr. Malkasian just reported, identity theft is, in fact, the fastest growing crime right now in the United States, and Oregon is, as he reported, a real center of that activity. Right now, Oregon ranks number 9 in the nation in terms of complaints to the FTC and in terms of actual cases of identity theft. It is a real legitimate problem here in Oregon. Until recently, the emphasis of our office, the emphasis of district attorneys around the state, and the efforts of Oregon consumers has been directed at protecting your own identity, making sure that you shred things before you put them in the trash, making sure that you're careful when you use the internet. It turns out that, in fact, identity thieves are using new mechanisms. We've just recently found that out in the cases that Mr. Malkasian indicated earlier, in which large companies are having problems with really voluminous amounts of personal information being released, in some instances inadvertently, in some instances because of some sort of wrongdoing by someone who's actively seeking that information. This bill addresses head-on some of those concerns. I think they are important concerns, and it's time for this legislature to follow the lead of other states that are considering or have enacted provisions similar to those contained in Senate Bill 1057. In addition to the 3 states that were identified earlier, in fact, there are 20 other states that are considering similar legislation. Right now, this is certainly right in the crosshairs of legislatures throughout the United States. I think that one of the key things that is affected by this bill is that it creates basically a mechanism for consumers to be proactive in protecting their own identity. It allows them to catch the problem before it starts. If, in fact, their personal identifying information has been released, they're alerted, and they can take some proactive steps to stop any sort of future identity theft that might occur. The FTC has indicated in my written remarks that the overall theft of identity, the overall cost of identity theft to those consumers is dramatically reduced if they catch it within the first 5 months. If they don't catch it within the first 5 months, it literally can mean hundreds of hours and tens of thousands of dollars in terms of lost wages and actual cost to the consumer in order for them to repair their good name. This bill gives them the ability to protect their good name before the victimization occurs. Again, Mr. Malkasian identified some of the key components of this bill in addition to the reporting requirements in case a breach of security has occurred. Those include protections for Social Security numbers, and those include the destruction of information that has or documents that have personally identifying information. The Attorney General vigorously supports those aspects of this bill as well. And the Attorney General again asked me to reiterate to this committee the importance of every section of this bill. We believe that as you consider the many amendments that are in front of you, that you need to take every step you can to enact the strongest consumer protections possible. I know the Dash 5 amendments exclude public bodies. I would tell you that the Attorney General's position is if you're going to require this on the business community, you better take a good hard look in the mirror and require it of our public agencies as well. We recognize that brings in some new challenges to the bill. But again, we think that, in fact, we all ought to be equally responsible for protecting the identity of Oregon citizens. And finally, I would add, because I know the Oregon District Attorney Association is not here today, that the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments were brought to you by the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I've talked to Kamala Sugar, who was the author of those amendments, and all they do is help ensure that prosecutors have the tools they need to prosecute these cases when they actually are, in fact, queued up for a criminal prosecution. I think they're relatively innocuous amendments. And I suppose I ought to add one last piece. Included in my testimony are a number of what we would consider very technical amendments that we think would help us to enforce this law or help individual citizens to enforce this law if, in fact, they are victimized as related in this law. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to my colleague here and answer any questions later.
Mr. Seeley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, my name is Bill Seeley. I'm with DMV, the Department of Transportation. Unlike my colleagues here, my appearance here today is to note a couple of places in the bill as we've analyzed it to see how we could effectively implement it and meet the needs that you've placed in the bill. We have a couple of spots where we'd like to bring some attention that there may need to be some change made. The first and probably the largest issue is in Section 2 of the bill on page 2. Our reading of that is that, and particularly where with the phrase owns, possesses, or uses, is the party that would be responsible for carrying out notification procedures. There are times when DMV, as a provider of millions of records each year, could still be considered the owner of those records. And once that's been provided to another government agency or to a business, if the breach of security occurs with that other agency or business, our reading of the bill right now is that it looks like this would also reach back to the source, which in this case would be DMV, and that we would also be responsible for following all of the notification procedures. We don't believe that we would have the wherewithal to do that because you have at least a once removed situation, but also it would be redundant. So if our reading is correct, we think some change needs to occur in that section of the bill just to make it clear that the agency or business that was the subject of the breach is the one that has a responsibility for the notification process. Of course, if that's us, that would be us, and we would do that. Secondly, there are a lot of laws already controlling how DMV information is available and to whom it is available, and they're pretty tight. Even though this bill would direct us to provide information to consumer reporting agencies as part of the notification procedure, we have some pretty precise laws that state who we can and who we cannot provide information to. Consumer reporting agencies are not on that list. We can have them added to that list, but our belief is that they would need to be added to that list for us to meet our obligation under the bill to notify the consumer reporting agencies. That's a fairly simple change, and we can provide the language to do that. Third area is probably very technical. It's in Section 5 relating to Social Security numbers. I won't go over what I've prepared in the testimony here, but we believe there's a little change needed there just to ensure that we are able to continue to provide Social Security numbers to other government agencies as existing state and federal law requires us to do, and we don't want anything to interfere with that. That concludes my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Seeley. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Mr. Seeley, I do want to ask, you and I had a conversation yesterday regarding some of the concerns that you've raised today. I had staff pull some of the bill that was passed back in, I believe it was 1997, that made a lot of substantial changes in DMV personal records that DMV retains. And going through that, I thought I actually saw where there was provisions in there that insulated DMV from liability, where, in fact, if someone you had, meaning the department, had actually made the records available under the, provisions of the bill that's now law, that the DMV itself would not be liable and indemnification would actually be required. Is that your understanding, that there are some safeguards in the 97 legislation that's now currently the statutes that DMV is operating under?
Yes, Mr. Chair, your reading of it is accurate. We have an indemnification clause in there that if you obtain it legitimately from us and then you misuse it, you yourself are the responsible party, and both the civil and criminal actions that can be brought against you in both state, at both the state and federal level, would be on you and you alone.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other questions? If not, thank you very much, and I appreciate both DMV as well as the DOJ being willing to work with us on language. My goal is based on the information that I received as of yesterday morning and through the day and into this morning, is to try to make these technical changes that we can before we send the bill out. I'd rather send a clean bill to the floor and know that we have a product that we're comfortable with to go to this over to the House. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm now going to call up, I believe it's Christine Avalero and Shannon Callahan. Can't deal with that. If y'all two would please come up. And then last I have up is Mr. Swank. I'm going to let you go ahead and come up on your own since you're going to be giving some opposition. And while this panel is coming forward, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 1057? And whoever would like to start off, feel free to go.
Chairman Prezonsky and members of the committee, my name is Christina Revelo. I represent Identity Safeguards, a firm in Tualatin, Oregon, and I'm an advocate for victims of identity theft both in Oregon and nationwide. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1057-1 and 2 based on that relationship that I have with victims. I represent hundreds of victims from across the nation. I have also been a victim of identity theft myself, and I have been involved in the industry professionally for over 2 years. This new industry is blossoming as a result of the proliferation of identity theft, and we are dedicated to taking every measure we possibly can to protect individuals from falling victim to this crime. Additionally, making sure we as business and government are doing everything we can to reduce the reaches of this crime. We cannot in good faith say we are doing everything to protect Oregonians and not support this bill. I am here today to testify personally and professionally, as I have worked on the behalf of victims from across the nation as well as in the state of Oregon. I understand that much of this proposal is modeled after California legislation and can professionally attest to the benefits that they afford California citizens and victims of identity theft from that state. I understand the state of Washington has also recently implemented similar notification laws. We are now positioned between two states with notification laws in the midst of this epidemic that is facing the West Coast. We must act now to protect ourselves. I would like to briefly share an example of the sort of thing that takes place every day in Oregon. I recently worked a case in which the victim discovered her personal accountant, who ran a home-based firm, had improperly disposed of her client's tax records. In this case, the mistake was a gross oversight on the part of the accountant. Shortly after tax day, she disposed of her records by tossing them into her curbside recycling bin. Sadly, thieves are well aware of the prime times to take advantage of us and do. They are well versed in their art, and without the implementation of certain laws, this kind of gross negligence and needless victimization will continue and thrive. My firm also recently responded to a local company who had experienced a security breach. We have seen so much of this in the headlines lately. This company, in response to California law requiring breach notification, was also thinking about the best interest of their affected customer base as a whole. They chose to engage my firm and undertake the notification of all affected individuals nationwide. They felt, as do I, that just because of a failure in a company's internal policy, innocent people should not have their lives upturned by identity theft. I can personally attest that the proactive measures this company took, as well as the solution they put into place, not only will ensure their customers are well cared for in the event their personal information is misused, but will also ease the situation as a whole and diffuse a lot of potentially charged emotions. In close, I can personally testify to the effectiveness of these provisions and strongly encourage you to support this timely bill. I urge you to consider notification laws in Oregon and allow Oregonians the same privilege and tools to safeguard themselves as I have personally seen work successfully in other jurisdictions. Tools like security freezes, which I have seen change the lives of California citizens whose personal information has been compromised from no wrongdoing of their own. With the few precautionary steps, we are affording individuals with yet another tool to use in the personal battle against identity theft. I appreciate the opportunity to testify and am available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Prasansky and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Callahan, and I'm a staff attorney and consumer advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest advocacy group with over 33,000 members. I'll try and keep my comments brief, as many of the things that others have mentioned are within my written testimony. I would like to bring your attention to the fact that in the last 2 years alone, identity theft has risen 45% in the state of Oregon. As well, nationally, this is costing $10 billion a year to both financial institutions and consumers. And increasingly, we know here in Oregon that those funds are being used to fund methamphetamine. I'd also like to point out just a couple of the samplings of breaches that have occurred just this year of people's personal information. 1.2 million consumers at Bank of America, 600,000 consumers at Time, I'm sorry, actually that would be employees at Time Warner, 310,000 consumers' information was breached at LexisNexis, 145,000 consumers' information was actually sold to a theft ring by ChoicePoint, 750 individuals have been confirmed victims of identity theft. These bills propose common sense solutions to prevent identity theft from occurring. They also provide the tools necessary to stop identity theft if someone's identity has been stolen. The security freeze is a simple tool that consumers can block access to their credit report. The consumer must take proactive action. The consumer can easily lift that freeze and continue to seek new credit. It also will not affect their current lines of credit, so a consumer can act as a consumer in the marketplace. So we urge you to support this bill. We would note that we support the -1, -2, -3, -4 amendments, but we would oppose the -5 amendments for the same reasons that Mr. Neely of the DOJ relayed to you. So I thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions for either of the two on the panel? Thank you very much for giving your testimony. What I'm going to do is we have two people who want to testify in opposition, Brad Swank as well as Judy Brandis. Why don't you all come up? What I'm going to do is recess just for a moment this public hearing. So I'm going to go ahead and recess at this point. Public hearing on Senate Bill 1057 for the purpose of opening a possible reconsideration and work session on Senate Bill 968. And so with that done, what we're going to do with this, what we're trying to do, I have two members that have to leave at 4 for another briefing, and I need to have four of my five committee members here to accomplish this task. And so, Senator Beyer, would you be so kind to make a motion for us on Senate Bill 968?
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended and the vote by whereby Senate Bill 968 was sent to the floor with amendments on April 28th be reconsidered.
Senator Beyer moves that the rules be suspended and the vote whereby Senate Bill 968 was sent to the floor with amendments on April 28th be reconsidered. This basically what we're attempting to do after we had had our hearing and we had actually did the work session, we passed the bill out assuming that the final set of the dash amendments, which I believe were the dash fours, included a provision that were in the dash threes members. Unfortunately, that had been dropped in the shuffle of making the changes on a quick turnaround. And so the purpose of bringing the bill back before us is so we can, in fact, consider the bill with the additional clause that was dropped. We also, Senator Beyer and I have had a discussion regarding one other issue that has come up. The purpose for moving the bill back before us, so we will have possession of it, and the attempt and goal will be to reach whatever resolution we can, and next Thursday at our next meeting, take action at that time. So, committee members, are there any discussion regarding the purpose or the reason for the motion that's before us? Is there any objection to the motion? Not seeing or hearing any, so ordered. And we now have taken repossession of Senate Bill 968, and as I stated, we'll have that set for this next meeting that we have scheduled, which is a week from today. With that, I'll close the, I guess that is the reconsideration, the motion to reconsider in the work session on 968. And at this time, I'll reopen public hearing that we have on Senate Bill 1057. And for those that are here, again, we apologize that we have members that have to leave, but because of all the duties we have, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to have everyone here. I will stay here. We'll hear all the testimony that we have on all the bills that we have. And so we will be sliding probably at some point into a subcommittee of the full committee. Ms. Brandis, I know you have a 4 o'clock, so if you'd like to go.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. I've had the opportunity to testify in front of many of you in this session and previous sessions on the issues of identity theft. I think, you know, it's fair to say that Associated Oregon Industries would like to do everything it can to protect identity theft. Our retailers that we represent generally also pay much of the cost of identity theft. I haven't gotten a full report back from some of our members that are looking at this bill as far as it relates to the security breach legislation. I don't think it's quite there yet, so to speak. And they'll be taking a look at the legislation in terms of the scope of who is what type of information is covered, for example, encrypted versus computerized information, how we do the notification to the customers, for example, what we are supporting across the nation, the retailers are at least, notification should only be required when there's either reasonable belief or actual knowledge that harm has been caused. You've taken care of the delayed notification if the law enforcement is involved. Delivery of notification, there is a concern about allowing notification delivered by direct mail or email, and in the event of a breach, if the notification cost exceeds a certain amount, how we take care of that. We do not support a private right of action under this legislation, and effective date, we do need some timing on that. I'd also point out on the Social Security section, some concerns about that I think are going to need some work. And I'm trying to find it. Here we go. When you talk about an employer relationship for internal verification or administrative purposes by the person's employee or agent for a legitimate purpose, I'm not quite sure what internal verification or administrative purposes means, and I'll give you an example. More and more of our employees are doing very thorough background checks on their potential employees for a variety of reasons. And so I'm not quite sure if that would be covered within that scope of doing that. So, of course, we need a Social Security number if we're going to do a thorough background check. So those are generally how people are looking at the bill throughout our retail community right now, and I haven't heard back from them and some concerns that we might have. And I just wanted to put those on the record.
All right, Ms. Brandis, thank you very much. And based on our schedule, if you have any feedback from your clients if you'll get that to myself or to Ms. Braun as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Brandis before she runs out the door? Sorry.
Well, I had about 10 minutes worth.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Mr. Swank,
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. Actually, I don't testify before this committee much, but there's a lot of very familiar faces here. I've checked on the sheet that we're in opposition to the bill, and that's probably a mischaracterization because most of the provisions of the bill we haven't taken a position on. If you look on page 2, at line 3, it defines personal information to not include publicly available information that is lawfully made available to the general public from federal, state, or local government records. And most of our concern is going to generate around that because we provide a ton of information through public records out of the courts. But
the sections that apply to personal information and our consumer protection issues are not things that we're concerned about. And actually, the section that does raise some concern for us, which is Section 5 dealing with Social Security numbers, we're not opposed to the concept. It's just that it presents a huge problem for us, as the chair and I have talked about before. We have in court records what we call our legacy records, which are all the court files which are sitting around in the 34 different court locations that we've got in this state, literally millions of records that have, paper records that have personal information in it, much of it Social Security numbers, some of it bank account numbers. There's all kinds of information in probate accounts, in divorce and dissolution proceedings, in proceedings relating to custody that's out there, and they're public records. As you know, we're mandated by the legislature to have in every civil judgment and in every criminal judgment to have the Social Security number included in the money award at the end of the judgment. That's part of the statute. And I actually worked against including that in the judgment when it was included in the mid-90s, saying you really want to go there. But now it's in every judgment that we've got by state law. And there's federal law that mandates that any judgment that involves involves support include a support award. I've been working since I started in the Judicial Department 19 years ago to try and move Social Security numbers out of the public records that we've got. We've been partially successful. In the last 4 years, we've made huge steps. We've moved Social Security numbers, which we used to collect on almost everything, out of the publicly available fields in OGIN, where people can see it on a public screen, so you can't go in and look. In 2004, we passed a uniform trial court rule that established a method, a procedure for people to segregate not just Social Security numbers, but any personal financial information from information that's publicly available in the court records, and to put it on a separate sheet so it could be segregated and kept confidential. And as of August 1st, there will be a new uniform trial court rule. The Chief Justice is going to sign the order as soon as we get the paperwork done that will take effect on August 1st to establish a procedure for people to be able to go into the existing court records and have personal financial information redacted and segregated so it's not available for public inspection. But all of those things being said, Section 5 makes it a misdemeanor for anybody to intentionally communicate or directly or indirectly display, sell, transfer, lease, loan, trade, rent, or otherwise disclose an individual Social Security number to a third party or to the general public without affirmatively expressed consent of the individual. Now, there's an exception. It says nothing in this section prohibits or limits the display or transfer of Social Security number required, authorized, or accepted under federal or state law. I'm not sure how much of the display or transfer of Social Security numbers in our public records is specifically authorized by federal or state law, but we've got a ton of those. So we're not against the concept of protecting Social Security numbers. As a matter of fact, when you introduce this kind of, the fact that this kind of introduced legislation has been introduced made it easier to get the Uniform Trial Court rule that's taking effect in August past, because people believe that you're taking this seriously. However, in terms of the records that we've got, in order to comply with Section 5, as I read it, and I'm sort of the public information officer for the courts, you know, we would have to comply with this. It would take an incredible amount of energy and resources and time and money if we're subject to Section 5 to be able to comply with that in terms of making sure that the public records that we have that are available to the public don't have Social Security numbers in it. And I'm sorry to tell you that, because I wish it weren't the case. I wish those Social Security, I wish that people hadn't, the records that we've got going back to 20s, I suspect that Social Security numbers started showing up in court files within a week of the time the Social Security Act took effect, and I don't remember when that was, because I suspect it was before I was born, or when I was very young at any rate. And they used to request them on almost every court form that was put out. Somebody would say, well, let's put a place for the Social Security number, just because they did. And a lot of agencies were that way. A lot of businesses were that way. And so we've got them. They're there. There are millions of them, potentially, in a lot of locations. Reviewing our records to redact that information, the legacy records, would be a huge expense for the state. And I can answer questions. And so technically we're not really opposed to the most of the bill. We're not opposed to the concept of protecting Social Security numbers, but we've got, like I say, in instances you've mandated that we put them in public records, the federal government has mandated we put them in public records, and we got a ton of them.
Mr. Swank, thank you very much for your testimony. I'll tell you that council and I have worked on this. We do think we have some fixes that we may need to implement to move the bill forward, taking in some of these concerns. I'm not comfortable bringing those out at this point until I got a little bit more handle on the issues that you've brought forward, and other agencies have too. But we will, in fact, do our best, because it's at least the chair's intent to move a product out and understand that this is probably going to be ongoing, meaning that we'll probably have to continue to tighten the bill up at once, if it makes it through this process through the next couple of years.
Thanks.
Any questions for Brad Swank? Thank you. If there's no one else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1057, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 1057. I'm going to go ahead and open, while I still have committee members here, a work session on House Bill 2127. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2127, we heard on April 12th. It lowers unemployment tax rates paid by employers and abolishes the state unemployment compensation benefit reserve fund. There was a revenue statement issued, and there's no fiscal impact. You want to know how it passed in the House?
Sure.
It passed in the House with 58 votes. 58 ayes.
I am.
I move House Bill 2127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 2127 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any question, any discussion, any objection? So ordered. Senator Byer, would you like to carry this one? Senator Byer will be our carrier. Thank you. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2127.
Thanks.
You bet. Thank you. And we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2125. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2125 holds Indian tribal employers to the same standards applied to local governments that pay unemployment insurance taxes for extended benefits. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. And let's see, on the list, and I'm going to probably not do the last name justice, Pat
Delaval.
Delaval?
Delaval.
Ms. Delaval, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah. My name is Pat Delaval, and I'm the manager of field operations for the Employment Department Tax Section. And I'm here to discuss House Bill 2125. That would amend Oregon law to treat tax-paying Indian tribes in the same manner as governmental entities for the purpose of charging extended benefits. And when I speak of extended benefits, I'm speaking of a specific federal-state program which is triggered in long periods of high unemployment. The Federal Consolidated Appropriations Act, or CAA, of 2001 required that all employees of Indian tribes be covered by unemployment insurance. In 2001, the Oregon Legislative Assembly passed House Bill 3596 to comply with this law. As a condition of state conformity, Indian tribes are given the same option available as other governmental entities, either to pay the quarterly payroll tax or reimburse the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund for benefits paid to employees. Under the Federal State Extended Unemployment Compensation Act of 1970, an extension of benefits may be available to unemployed individuals during long periods of high unemployment. For for-profit employers, the state UI Trust Fund and the federal government each pay 50% of extended benefits. However, the federal government does not pay anything for governmental entities or Indian tribes. Governmental entities and Indian tribes that reimburse for benefits paid pay 100% of the benefits. Tax-paying governmental entities are taxpaying governmental entities are charged one-half benefits, but due to an oversight in the passage of House Bill 3596, language to charge Indian tribes was omitted. This bill will correct that by inserting language that provides for taxpaying Indian tribes to pay one-half of extended benefits. And without this, the state unemployment trust fund pays for all of it. The effects are that House Bill 2125 will amend Oregon Revised Statute 657 to add language to treat taxpaying Indian tribes the same as taxpaying governmental entities in charging extended benefits for unemployment insurance tax. It will not affect Indian tribes that have elected to reimburse the trust fund for benefits paid. The fiscal impact on the Employment Department is negligible, and currently there are 9 federally recognized Indian tribes in Oregon with 28 taxpaying accounts. Of these, 13 would have been charged extended benefits. And of these 13, only 2 would have had any difference in their tax rates in 2005, one by 0.1% and one by 0.3%. No other accounts would have been affected. These changes will have no effect on administrative costs. And extended benefits were available from January 2002 through December 2003. We do not anticipate this to be triggered again soon. And it will also not affect Oregon emergency benefits in House Bill 3305, since no employing entity will pay for those benefits. A letter was sent out to the tribes in June 2004 regarding this change, and to my knowledge, we've not received any negative response. This concludes my testimony. I'm willing to stay for questions.
Thank you very much. Since I do not have any questions, Council, do you have any questions?
I'm okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2125? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2125. Thank you again for your testimony. What I'm going to do, I'm looking at how many people I have in the room. Instead of making everyone stay here as long as I get to stay here, I'm going to go ahead and jump to the bottom of the list. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2740. And I'm going to ask Sean Miller, Daryl Fuller, and I'm going to go ahead and ask Eva Tayros to please come forward as the first panel. I would love to.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2740A clarifies the responsibilities of motor vehicle brokers and details disclosure requirements, prohibits broker from receiving a fee from both the buyer and the seller.
Mr. Chairman and Anna, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, and I know I have spoken to the chair about this bill, House Bill 2740, which we support wholeheartedly, and it's something that we have introduced to clear up some gray area in the auto broker statute, and as well as provide some consumer protections that were not in the law. In the last, especially few years, it's brought to light that those consumer protections would need to be in the law. It's a bill that we have worked with, that the industry brings to the committee. It's been a long negotiated process with the Department of Justice, and I appreciate their help and support of drafting House Bill 2740A. And the 3 different provisions within the bill, and I think Ms. Braun mentioned them, it's in my written testimony, Mr. Chair, so I'll be brief. It's just dealing with broker compensation and disclosure requirements, where the broker may receive a fee from the customer, or the broker may receive compensation from the owner, which would, in many cases, is the auto dealer themselves, but they cannot receive a compensation from both of the individuals. There's disclosure requirements that outline those provisions in the bill. That was a very carefully written section that, again, the Department of Justice helped us draft. The second provision creates a bright line between the auto broker and the dealer business activities. This deals with the auto broker who is representing a customer and in some cases will then change relationships because they have a their own inventory. And this requires disclosure requirements to allow the customer to understand that relationship and that change in relationship. And finally, the last provision, Mr. Chairman, prohibits false advertising. It was an issue that was, again, goes back to the compensation issue of being compensative on both sides and portraying some to a customer that it's actually free when, in fact, it wasn't. And that's an issue that we feel should be cleared up in the statute. And, Mr. Chairman, if there's any questions, I would just leave it at that and would ask the committee, whenever you have a quorum, to move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know Mr. Fuller is not with us, but we instead have
Jose Pino Mesa, the first vice president of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee there. What we've done is taken a lot of time and hours spent with this. We have a lot of help from Department of Justice, who Eva is here representing today, AAA Oregon Idaho, Credit Union Association, and the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. We are all in favor of this bill. We think it's something that's going to be beneficial to consumers. And I'm not going to repeat too much what Sean said, but as a car dealer in Portland, many times I also broker cars as well, and I think this is something that should be here, like it's happening in many other states as well. And so when the time comes, we ask that you please pass House Bill 2748. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Tayrolls.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Eva Terrace, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice, the Consumer Protection Financial Fraud Section. I, too, will be brief. The auto broker industry has changed a great deal since ORS 822-047 was first enacted in 1993. HB 2740 is a consensus bill that amends that statute to more clearly set forth a broker's role in an auto buying or leasing transaction and what disclosures a broker must provide the consumer. The department's written testimony goes into more depth about what prompted this legislation and the specific provisions of the bill. If you have any questions, I'm sure any of us will be more than happy to answer them.
All right, thank you. Well, I'm going to not give you any questions right now, but Ms. Tayrolls, I'm going to ask you to please stay by. I do have two other people who are going to be testifying, Mr. McKinney and Mr. King, and I do want you to be by just because I think there's going to be some points of clarification I may want to have regarding the leasor or leasee issue.
Okay.
So thank you very much for coming forward. Mr. McKinney and Mr. King.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Who's first?
Mr. McKinney, why don't you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and go ahead and give us your testimony. Thank you, sir.
My name is Joseph McKinney. I'm the president of Oregon Roads Vehicle and Equipment Leasing and Finance in Eugene, Oregon. House Bill 2740 is an attempt to regulate the auto broker industry in Oregon, yet oversteps its bounds and accidentally regulates unrelated industries. The implications may result in the restraint of trade, diminished economic activity, and a loss of competitiveness for Oregon businesses. The industries affected by this legislation include the leasing and finance business, trucking, motorhome, trailer and RV manufacturers, and corporate fleets. All of these industries require dealers and brokers to facilitate the sale, leasing, and financing of their products. I've owned and managed a leasing and finance company in Eugene for 15 years after locating here from Washington, D.C., the land of regulation. The brokering and rebrokering of a lease, which is a financial product, is as common as the brokering and sales of mortgages. It is an essential component of portfolio management. If my business was unable to broker the leases and finance contracts that facilitate the sale of trailers, motorhomes, and other manufactured products, Lane County manufacturers would suffer. Approximately $4 million in annual sales would either disappear or move outside of Oregon. I can list similar circumstances that would restrict corporations in their sale of fleet vehicles. Who knows the impact this may have on Freightliner and other trucking industry suppliers? I had considered suggesting that all references to leasing, lessee, and lessor be removed from HB 2740. I would advise instead that banks, leasing and finance companies, corporate fleets, trucking companies, and motorhome trailer and RV dealers and manufacturers be exempt from this legislation. Thank you for your careful consideration of my concerns. I would also like to state that the Attorney General's Office put a working group together over a year ago and invited dealer associations and credit unions, but did not involve banks, leasing or finance companies, trucking companies, corporate fleets, all these other elements. And the last thing I'd like to add is that we could have a law that would be a lot more succinct than HB 2740. We could do it in one sentence. New car dealers would not pay fees to brokers, and that would deal with the same issue with more brevity. Thank you very much.
Why don't you stand by? Mr. King, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Monty King. I'm the president of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association, Oregon Power Sports Association. I will be brief, too. Basically, I want to make sure it's in the record that if a dealer has broker on their sign, a broker on their name, a broker on their website, or anywhere else, they are a broker right then and there, and they need to be disclosing that to their customers. This is going to change probably some names in the industry, but when they're advertising that they're a broker, then they're first a broker. Of course, they don't. There's another way to be a broker, and that's to represent themselves as a broker, even if they don't do signage. But if they do the signage, then they're a broker, and they need to be disclosing that, I think. You don't have to be a broker, though, if you don't own the car, but when the person says, hey, I want a car. Because if a dealer goes down to the auction and gets a car at the auction that somebody wants, hey, I want a 95 Chevy, can you get me one? That's not being a broker if you go down to the auction, buy one, and bring it back. Because the person doesn't have to buy it. It is going to be in the dealer's stock. But the timing of the disclosure is very important, especially when they've advertised that they're a broker. As far as the advertising violations that happened before, those were already violations. It's against the law to say something's free when it's not free. It is good to have it in the bill. I agree with that. Other products can be sold by a broker when they're brokering a car also, just like they do in finance deals now. And I'm beginning to see some logic in what Joe McKinney says, is why not have finance companies in here too, if they're brokering finance? I'm not sure of what all the ramifications are. I'm not as skilled in that industry as Joe is and some other people are. But I do know if there's a problem, we will come back next session, and we will ask to have that fixed if we see any problems. And I'll work closely with Joe and with the time period if that's going to happen, and with the Department of Justice and others.
Thank you. Mr. Rose, I know this is, I don't want to put you on the spot. You got, hopefully, a copy of the written material from Mr. McKinney?
I guess if I can get a copy.
And I don't know if you want to put anything on the record today, that'd be fine. If you're not comfortable doing that, I would be willing to accept something that would be in writing. Specifically, I think the issues that when Mr. McKinney and I spoke by phone, he had issues regarding, as he first said in the last paragraph, the references regarding leasing, lessee, and lessor, and now he's raised the other issues that are in the second sentence of that last paragraph. And I'm assuming that the work group had some discussions, because I understand Mr. McKinney was at least at one of those meetings, and I assume some of those concerns regarding the leasing, and lessor was brought up. And could you just, for the record, so we can have it on the record as to what was discussed, why they're in the bill, and what, if any, impact does it have as to what Mr. McKinney's concerns are?
Sure. I might need some more time to look at more fully at all of the issues that he's raised. But during the work group, which met a few times over the past month or two, I believe, it's been a fairly recent work group, we did discuss if lease should be included in this bill, and we decided that it should be, because whether a broker assists a consumer in outright buying a car or leasing a car, in either instance, a consumer is getting a car using a broker's services. So the consumer doesn't really care so much if they're purchasing the car, say, through a cash or through some type of loan that they get, or if they're leasing a car for a period of time and then you know, they'll have to find a new lease or find a new car or something else. Either way, the consumer is going to the broker for the services that the broker is providing. The consumer wants a car, the broker is helping them find that car. So that's, I guess, in a nutshell, why we thought that lease should also be included, because to the consumer, it doesn't matter so much how the car is obtained. The consumer is looking for the broker to provide a certain service for obtaining a vehicle on their behalf.
Okay. So the way I understand it, it's the issue that what we're trying to do is whoever's brokering whatever vehicle arrangement could be as an outright buying or if it's a brokering for a lease, we wanted to make certain that the broker relationship to be identified and made public to the consumer.
Correct. So the consumer is clear on what type of relationship that is, no matter if it's a purchase or a lease.
Okay. And regarding the last sentence regarding advising us that maybe these different areas of the industry should be exempt, if you're not comfortable responding to that now, I guess I would like for you to reflect on that and let us know. Because I do not have a full committee, I cannot move the bill, and I just want to put things on the record. You know, I can tell you my intention is to move the bill. I understand Mr. McKinney. Concerns, and I know that he said that he did not, at least from the message I got, want to impede the bill from moving forward. But if there's something that we need to address or we should address that maybe wasn't addressed during the work group, I think this would be the time to at least consider it while we wait for it until I have a committee, which will be next week. And if we come to agreement and wanting to make some changes in between now and then, we can do that. If not, the intention of the chair will be to move the bill out as is, based on what the work group came together, and then as Mr. King has said, we can monitor this, and I'd expect that the DOJ would, in fact, advise us, and Mr. McKinney, if we find that there are some problems, we would address it at that time. I'm going to give it some consideration to see whether or not we need to do anything immediately. If the work group believes you've raised some new concerns that were not addressed, then let's look at them now. If not, we'll move the bill, and we'll monitor it over the next 2 years. Any other thoughts or questions? Mr. McKinney.
Well, there's something duplicitous here, and I think it's because there was no new car dealer representative at the meeting, and there was nobody from the leasing business. But a sale can be financed, it can be leased, it can be financed through a credit union, it could be a balloon note financed instrument, it could even be a private party contract. Those are all methods of paying for a vehicle. If we were to delete lease from this, it would still regulate brokers bringing vehicles to dealers, because a dealer requires that a purchase order be signed at the time of a lease. The lease is merely the finance instrument.
Okay.
So it's duplicitous, and then it opens the can of worms and regulates an industry other than brokering business.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming up, giving us the testimony. It's on the record. As I said, we have a week to kind of look at this. I believe there may be one or two other individuals that might want to give some testimony now. And so I'm going to ask you all to step back. And again, thank you, Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest that just in case somebody have an amendment draft to take it out, just in case we need it next week, if you're going to do it on Thursday. I think we have time to get it done if you want to do it. I see what Joe says. We don't have financing in there. We're talking brokering about getting the car. It's not about the financing. It's not how the car is financing. And leasing is just a way of financing. It's, yeah, you're getting the car too, and you're kind of a temporary owner. The leasing is the financing. But I understand some of what DOJ is saying too. So experts need to talk about it. But if we have it ready, we're ready.
We've got a week. We'll take care of what we need to take care of, hopefully, fingers crossed. And I appreciate everyone for coming forward today. Thank you very much. Before I close the hearing on 2740, if there's anyone else that wanted to give testimony today, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, Larry Campbell representing AAA. Just to clarify a couple of points, I understand Mr. McKinney's concerns, but I'd like to point out that the new car dealers were a very intricate part of the group that met. Mr. Al DeBoer from the Southern Oregon, as well as the lobbyist Daryl Fuller, were at all meetings. My understanding is that Mr. McKinney is represented by Monty King, and Monty certainly was involved in all meetings. What we basically were attempting to accomplish with this bill is to develop a transparency and a protection for consumers. AAA has had its share of opportunities as a result of being a partner in a brokerage operation. And one of the things that we found is that it was very difficult to understand the process. It was very difficult for us to understand exactly how things were supposed to work in order to protect the consumer. And one of the objectives of this entire operation was to find a way of making sure that we did protect the consumer and that we were able to educate and provide information for all of the brokers. It's interesting that a number of people who have been identified as brokers in the past since this operation started have even changed their titles on their web pages and so forth. Our objective is to make sure that the consumer is protected. We believe that this legislation accomplishes that. It was a very contentious piece of legislation to begin with, and I would like to identify our appreciation to the Department of Justice, who worked with us very carefully to make sure that we weren't injured by what we were trying to accomplish. And I also want to say that the group that worked together worked very well together, and consensus was the key. So we would hope that you would move this legislation forward so that it can become law. The benefactor will be the consumer, certainly not the brokers, although we will benefit if we're brokers by the fact that we now understand the guidelines and will have some clear direction. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Ms. Braun, do you have any questions?
Oh, he does have a question. Gotcha.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very pleased that Senator Beyer had to leave early.
Oh, don't leave. I think Ms. Braun actually has one. Yeah.
You can ask it.
No, go ahead.
My first question.
She's been waiting all session, I guess.
Who was on the work group exactly? Do we have that here?
We can give you an entire list of all the people that were on the work group and what their associations are.
Oh,
we'll be happy to do that.
Mr. Campbell.
That was so easy.
That was a softball. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
You bet. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2740 at this time, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2294. And Mr. Moore, how are you doing today?
I'm just fine, Your Honor.
Your Honor.
Trying to butter me up already.
I'll confess I was in the Court of Appeals on Thursday and the Supreme Court on Monday, so I've got the Your Honor on the brain. Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I practice workers' compensation representing injured workers. I'm here today, though, speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. In particular, I am co-chair of a legislative subcommittee of the Workers' Compensation Section's Executive Committee to the Oregon State Bar. And that's a committee composed of attorneys representing insurance companies, self-insured employers, and injured workers. And we spent the last couple years working on this piece of legislation. In order to get there, we had to reach consensus. And this represents our agreement of what of some changes we'd like to see in the law. I should also say that our subcommittee passed its recommendations up to the executive committee. They had to agree on them also by consensus. They're also composed of members from all sides of the bar. And then the Board of Bar Governors of the Oregon State Bar had to approve this as well. Essentially, what we have is a proposal to make some changes in a part of the workers' compensation statute that refers to the workers' compensation board's own motion authority. Own motion claims are claims where the right to reopen the claim has expired, and the board has authority to order those claims reopened and to order payment of certain benefits. The problem that we identified arose out of the board's interpretation of some law that was passed in, I believe, 1997, could be 1999, to deal with the Johansson case, and it took claims that are referred to as new or omitted medical condition claims and required that the board process those claims under its own motion authority. The board interpreted the law to require that they had the original jurisdiction in determining acceptance or denial of the claim. And what we have proposed is that rather than having the board do that, that the insurer, self-insured employer, their claims processor make the initial determination to accept or deny the new or omitted own motion or new or omitted medical condition claims, that the injured worker then has a right to request a hearing, and that would proceed in the normal hearing process to an administrative law judge with a potential appeal to the Workers' Compensation Board and possibly to the Court of Appeals. Insurers and self-insured employers, at least their attorneys, were in favor of that. We believe that our proposed amendments to the law will make the law simpler and easier to manage those claims and provide a benefit to both sides in that. I will say also we've taken this bill to the Management Labor Advisory Committee and they have agreed to it, and of course it's passed out of the House as well. There's one additional change that this bill makes with regard to own motion cases. At present, own motion cases cannot be appealed except under some very limited circumstances. There was a time when the own motion statute represented there were no real statutory limits on what the board could or could not do, very, very limited restriction on their authority. The own motion statute was about providing the board discretion to act. Since about 1987, we've had a variety of statutory changes imposing some burdens on the board, requiring them to do certain things or prohibiting them from doing certain things. If the board misinterprets law, misinterprets a statute, there are circumstances, or if they interpret the statute in a way that one party believes is a misinterpretation of the law, is what I guess I should say, unless benefits are terminated or reduced for the claimant cannot appeal. Unless the benefits are increased, the insurer cannot appeal. And we are proposing to change that. The purpose of allowing the appeal is not to allow an appeal of the board's discretionary acts, but to allow an appeal in those circumstances when a party believes that there's been a misapplication of the law. And it is simply a matter of trying to get a very few instances of decisions in front of an appellate court to have that court interpret the law and tell us what the law actually is. Unless, sir, if you have questions, I'm happy to answer any.
I don't have any questions.
I don't have any.
Mr. Moore, thank you very much for coming up. I appreciate your time. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2294, and that leaves us, I believe, with one other bill for public testimony, and that's House Bill 2718. I'll open that public hearing at this time. And Gary? I'm afraid we may be losing all of our audience, or most of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Braun. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I'll go through this real brief. We're a self-insured employer that provides utility services in Oregon. Under Oregon law, a self-insured employer is required to purchase excess insurance coverage for his workers' compensation coverage. The market for excess insurance to utilities is limited. The current provider that we purchase from, in the law, it requires us to purchase from a insurance provider that's authorized to do business in the state of Oregon. We do that. Our insurance provider right now has told us over the last few years that they're really not sure they want to keep writing the policy, and each year we go back and say, please help us, please write the policy. What they do right now is actually write the policy and then turn around and go out to a surplus lines carrier. After discussions with the workers' compensation folks, we developed House Bill 2718 to allow a public utility, and we limit it to just the larger public utilities that are regulated by the PUC, mm-hmm. to obtain excess insurance coverage from an eligible surplus lines carrier. And that then would allow us, if appropriate, to go out and purchase directly from them. We believe we've maintained a level of protection for workers by limiting it to larger entities. All of these utilities, if they choose to go this route, and there's only six, do file regular financial reports annually with the Public Utility Commission. We're regulated. We can't change our business operations. We can't sell our businesses. We can't do anything without state approval. And then the other thing, if we do this, we would go and look for a financially sound self-insured or surplus lines carrier, and the workers' compensation folks have the ability to write rules if they choose to kind of define the financial stability of that type of a carrier. And I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
We'll
go ahead and close the public hearing on 2718. And before we do anything else, is there any other business for the subcommittee of the full committee?
I think we're in it.
So I'll go ahead and close what has now become the subcommittee of the full committee of commerce, and we will be adjourned.